and welcome to episode 86 of the Awesome Comics Podcast, the place where the small press makes one hell of a big noise. I'm your host, Vince Hunt, creator of The Red Mask from Mars, and joining me for this week's batch of comic greatness are writer, artist, and creator of the webcomic Vanguard, Dan Butcher.
Hello.
And Down the Tubes contributor, comic writer, and our very own vegetable medley, Tony Esmond.
I thought I was going to try and get into the fact that I was just talking about having sex with a Red Mask from Mars mask on, but couldn't quite get there.
No, but you still mentioned it though, didn't you?
Yeah.
You just can't be stopped.
You've got to think of it.
You're like a human Pringle tube, you are. Anyway, and this week we're also joined by a special guest. He's the creator behind the brilliant book Surface Tension, Mr. Yep. Jay Gunn.
Hello, good to be here.
Hey, Jay. Good to have you on, mate. Yeah.
How are you finding good. The atmosphere? Is it nice? You know, we've got the lights down low. We've got some Kenny G playing in the background.
It's everything I wanted it to be.
Yes.
I've read Surface Tension again today, so I'm officially fucking freaked out.
You know, I thought I was actually making kind of a bit of a nice book, but I forget how weird it is sometimes.
Yeah, it's cracking that, mate. We really like
it.
Yeah, it's really good.
Fan of it.
Yeah,
we've got some great books and some interesting topics to talk about this week. But first, I wanted to start off by saying thank you to Mr. Daniel Butcher for bringing Surface Tension fully to my attention.
Yeah.
It was one of those books that was sort of on the periphery. You know, I would see images of covers and like some amazing artwork in between, but I'd never read it, and it wasn't until like Dan fully jammed it in my face. What am I talking about?
Yeah,
well, it's just by chance, by talking to Jay on Twitter, and then saw some of his work and then said give it a punt.
And then
find a gem, a diamond in the rough. Yeah. Brilliant.
Yeah. We're properly fluffing him up, aren't we?
We're a diamond in the rough of Twitter.
Yeah.
I've often been described as a diamond, in the rough. So. Yeah.
And Twitter is a rough place at the moment. But Surface Tension itself, not enough people may not know about it. So, so for those who don't know, Jay, just tell us a little bit more about the initial concept of Surface Tension.
Okay. There's been a phenomenon that spreads across the world known as the seasickness. And once you contract this illness, you have an irresistible kind of pull to the coastlines around the world. So this spreads across the entire globe, and 99% of humanity gathers on the coastline staring out to sea. And out to sea, these strange coral towers have grown out of the oceans, and nobody quite knows what they're doing there and how they came about. And then everybody who's has this illness just disappears into the ocean and just melts into the water, never seen again. And then the story takes place on a small British Channel island, a fictional island off the Jersey, that kind of Sark sort of area of the Channel Islands. And there's a small community still surviving on one of the islands that was untainted by this sickness. Hmm. And they cannot leave their island because now strange, gigantic, leviathan-like creatures exist in the ocean. And then one day, two people are washed up ashore, from one from the island and one from the mainland, with no memory of where they've been or how they got there, and that's the starting point.
Yeah.
So, were you on many hallucinogens when you came up with this concept?
That's one way of putting it. I kind of wanted to write kind of like a sort of a positive story about a message about the environment and how we kind of pull together and so on.
Yeah.
And then I read a review by someone online saying, this book is full of weirdness. It's got kids melting in the water and people with body parts dropping off and babies being turned into creatures. I thought, it was a bit weird after all, wasn't it? Yeah.
I take
the point.
Yeah. Do you know what I most admired about it is the fact that as soon as you start on page one, it fucking cranks up the weirdness. I mean, so many books like take so long to get going, don't they?
Yeah.
And they just sort of so decompressed these days. But on the first one, you got Blue Man's Wiener, and then page two, you got some weird sort of creature with a skull and looks a bit like a fat baby.
Yeah, the first episode it has everything, nudity, dinosaurs, mystery. So first issue, just go for it. First pages.
And as reading it, I thought, fuck me, where can he go now? But you go there. Do you know what I mean? It keeps going. It keeps getting stranger and stranger. Mm.
Yeah.
And I honestly do genuinely think it defies description, really, because it's so visual, isn't it?
It's really hard. I mean, it's really hard to sum it up because it kind of moves around all over the place. I think, obviously, I think the marketing guys at Titan maybe didn't quite know how to describe it either.
Right. Okay.
It's interesting you mentioned to me about the cover. The marketing guys were saying like we want the kind of the people, the seasickness people on the cover, like looking a bit Walking Dead-esque.
And
was that like, was their influence like loomed large on that? That's what you got to do.
I think the problem is obviously, you know, people have got to sell you know their books and whatever, and so they try to look at trends. You know, I had this from when I used to work in video games. You know, the marketing people try to look at what's popular at the moment. And so obviously the book was sold on, you know, it's the Walking Dead meets, you know, whatever, insert whatever title you want there. That's good, but the problem with that is I, at the time I had the impression that everybody was selling a zombie comic. You know,
Like
everywhere you move there's bloody zombies and zombies in films, zombies in games, zombies in comics, and I thought this is just not even a zombie comic, but because there was this epidemic, this seasickness where people melt, it looked a bit like zombie imagery. So and there's a bit of survival in there, but it's not a survival horror in the Walking Dead or the Crossed sort of, you know, style. It's not brutal in that respect.
No.
So, you know, they thought, okay, we'll sell it as a Walking Dead thing, and I don't know whether or not that helped or was a disservice. I'm not too sure, but I know when people review it sometimes they go, oh, I thought it was just another zombie comic, so that popped up a lot.
Okay.
So that certainly flagged up a few warnings for me,
because having read it, the cover is metaphorical for the story, isn't it? You know, you've got the normal person walking into the Red Sea, you know, with the people behind, so there is there's metaphors for it, but some of the visuals are so much better to in my opinion to the almost just human structures on the front cover. You know, there's a couple of things. Do you think that would have done it a disservice by putting like a huge monster on it? Would that have taken you down a whole different sort of marketing route, do you think?
Well, I remember once reading an interview with someone from 2000 AD. I can't remember who it was. This was a long time ago. I remember them saying whenever we put a dinosaur on the cover, you know, from Flesh or Satanus from Judge Dredd or whatever, they always sold a lot more copies. So, you know, but that's the kids, obviously, and nowadays something like Supercentury is not really read by kids, but kids love monsters and stuff. And I know that a lot of people did respond really well to the monsters in Surface Tension. So it certainly could have moved it into different areas. But I know that when I go to like comic conventions and stuff or you know, signing things, a lot of the people who come up to buy the book are actually women and kids, so it's got a female readership.
Right.
And I think that's because they liked some of the other imagery in the book. Like, there's one cover I really liked, which wasn't really used as a cover, which had this, you know, the Japanese character, Megumi Suzuki, the female character, sitting on a hillside with flowers, with a strange statue behind her and a masked figure.
Yes,
and that kind of
that
conjured
cover.
Up, like nature and mystery. Like, who's that figure with a mask on? And why is she sitting there? Why is it all lovely, but something bad has happened? So that kind of, it keyed into that kind of the fact that a lot of female readers like a mystery and those kind of images.
Fairy tale thing going on a little
bit. Yeah, so you could have sold it along that sort of like, you know, a bit like a Studio Ghibli sort of esque sort of thing with, you know, with horror.
But I think the covers also, they built, because the book, you've got these epic monsters and you've got the, you know, these weird, strange, and it is truly epic.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of emotion and it's a very personal story. And like, you know, because it's like a small island, you know it's not, you know, everything does feel more personal, and that also comes across in the covers, because I know this particular book has one of my favorite covers of like the past few years, which is I think it's the chapter 4 where you have the girl in the yellow jacket and she's there's a tear rolling down her cheek as like there's a
that's a brilliant cover.
That is just that one image alone, that just speaks volumes, because there's just, you know, you got this strange character design, but also it's a real touching moment.
Yeah,
I think that kind of sums up a lot of what goes through the book.
It was a very personal story at the time. I mean, I don't want to get too much into details, but when I was writing and drawing Surface Tension, I had cancer. It's all over now, so it's good. In a good way. But I was kind of like, I said to Titan, so, you know, I'm going through this thing right now. It's going to be a bit difficult, but I still want to go ahead with the comic, you know, I still want to finish it and everything. And when you go through that time, you don't know what the outcome is. So I said to Titan, my editors, who were really understanding, I said, you know, can I add some of this into the scripts, you know, rewrite bits of the scripts based on this kind of physical thing that I'm going through. And they were like very supportive. Like, yeah, go for it.
Oh, cool.
So a lot of that kind of imagery of the kind of the sort of the body horror sort of thing.
Yeah.
And the cover with the guy who's kind of changing, you know, with his girlfriend, with the tear and everything. That was all kind of came from that personal time of going through that that period in my life. So that's why some of that stuff comes out into the comic. But you're throwing monsters and things like that in there as well, because you don't want to make it super depressing or everything. But a lot of that was quite personal sort of imagery.
Yeah.
So it did speak a lot for something at the time.
I've read this twice this week, and that just you saying that brings such a different meaning to what I've read as well, you know? Incredible stuff, dude. It is genuinely one of the best books I've read for a long time. Absolutely.
Oh, I really, really appreciate
that. Yeah. I was just looking at one of my favourite pages, and it's where the ginger-haired girl is talking to the guy from the cover.
Yeah.
And she says, he's a close friend, he's been good for me. And he goes, yeah, I bet he has. And then there's just a picture of her face, like, looking at him, and then going, unbelievable. What a stupid self. And it's some of the best facial acting I've seen in ages. Yeah. So good.
That's it.
You've thrown a bit of a carry-on joke into the middle of it, and it just works so well.
Yeah. It's because, like, you know, you have good characters, don't you, in comics?
Yeah.
And stuff, and, like, we're all good guys, but we do say dickish things to our girlfriends and wives and stuff. You know, you can't help it. So, yeah, that was, I say stupid stuff, and I thought, yeah, this guy is going through this bad, you know, time in his life, but he's still a bit of a dick, you know. But he means well, but, you know, stuff comes out and, you know, you're going to offend your other half.
And
I kind of tried to get that into that scene. Of like, he's not a Superman, you know, he's a bit of an idiot.
On an artistic front, the kind of where you've gone around and looked at places and taken a lot of reference visually and put that in, that real kind of brings over a sense of Britishness in the book, like it feels very much like where it that does. Place could be real.
Yeah, it's got a Wicker Man feel to it to me.
Yeah.
A little bit of that, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I love the Wicker Man's one of my favourite films. And I grew up, well, I didn't grow up by the coast, but my parents had this little caravan that we'd go off to in the school holidays. And I used to kind of hate going there because it meant I wasn't near my computer or, you know, comic shops and stuff. So I'd take all my comics with me and sit on the beach reading them. And this is a true story, but when I used to get every time I used to get to the beach one summer, there was this massive dead seal had washed up onto the beach, and nobody moved it. They just all sat around it, like trying to ignore it. And every week it rotted more and more and more, so you could see the skeleton coming through the skin and stuff. So I was sat there reading my 2000 ADs and stuff, and kept glancing over at this thing. So it stopped looking like a seal after a while. It started looking at some weird, you know, like zombie dinosaur thing that had washed up on the coach on the coastline. And
there's I was going to ask you about influences, but that's all you need to know. That moment.
Yeah, so that's stuck in my mind a bit. So yeah, it's kind of like So yeah, nice, colourful, you know, sunny location with a rotting carcass. That's Britain for you.
Yeah, it could be Chatham in an evening. Do you know what I mean? But I know what you mean. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Can I do some guessing at influences, if you mind, Jay? Okay, right. Obviously, Mobius, I'm going to say.
I love Mobius. Got a story about Mobius, actually.
Oh, go on then.
I discovered Mobius through my when I was a kid. I was going through my parents' bedroom, as you do sometimes, and I found a load of my dad's porn magazines stashed under the bed.
Here we go.
And I was like looking through these porn magazines, and in the porn magazines was a copy of Heavy Metal magazine, the American version of Metal Hurlant, which was almost like a porn magazine.
Yeah.
And I put the porn magazines aside because I was a kid. I loved 2000 AD and comics and stuff. So
yeah.
And I was flicking through Heavy Metal, and for a 10-year-old kid, it was really confusing because it's like tits and stuff. But also this amazing artwork, and I didn't know at the time, but it was Mobius.
Right.
Because the Mobius stuff was reprinted in the American Heavy Metal.
Yeah.
And I think it was the Airtight Garage or its sequel. So I was like mesmerized by this, like, it was like reading 2000 AD, but like a naughty version for adults.
Yeah.
And so that Mobius thing and that kind of like European style was just, that was it. It was stuck in my brain. So.
Yeah. I was going to say European style because he's so, but I was also going to say Leo, if you've read any of his stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Aldebaran, I don't know how to pronounce that. Yeah, I like his stuff, yeah.
He's got that creature design, not similar to yours, but that originality to his creature design that I see in your work.
Yeah. I definitely would agree with that.
Okay, cool. And for the quality of your line and certainly your colouring, I'm going to say Brian Talbot, sort of one bad rat type era. that sort of thing.
Yeah, a lot of people do say that. Yeah, I really do admire that. That's one of my comic books that I discovered when I was an adult and just thought, wow, yeah, people are talking about, like, you know, real social issues and stuff. So
yeah, right, brilliant. Yeah. And the other thing I was going to say was John Wyndham. I was going to say a combination of the chrysalids and the Kraken Wakes.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I love that kind of, like, I mean, it's aged quite badly now, hasn't it? But I like that kind of kind of middle class kind of sci-fi thing where people get around dinner tables and just discuss the problem.
Everyone's boss, aren't they? Everyone.
Exactly. Yeah. That's my the dinner scene in Surface Tension where, you know, they've got the candles out and eating, you know, whatever, you know, fondue or something whilst discussing, you know, what's going on. So that was my direct homage to this John Wyndham, you know,
middle-class people. Last week at the 2000 AD event, Pat Mills pointed out the fact that, like, a lot of these books would always be kind of middle to upper class people dealing with problems. And I didn't really ever kind of consider that. And then when he brought that up, I was like, yeah, actually, that's a really good point.
I remember in the radio play of Day of the Triffids, they're sort of travelling across the country and they discover this girl who's sort of been stranded. Her parents have died, and she lives in a farmhouse. But of course, she's posh, isn't she?
Of course, everyone they meet.
And if you're a bit of a sort of Cockney, then you're going to be wrong, aren't you? There's going to be you're going to be a gangster.
Up in the Was, wasn't it? There was a bit of a sort of gangstery sort of character that come across the.
There was, wasn't there? Yeah, a bit of a sort of anti-hero,
a wide boy.
Yeah,
Pat Mills is absolutely right. In the 1970s and 60s and 50s, everyone was middle class or posh. Yeah, definitely.
That's kind of, in a way, that's what makes the stories what they are, that where it kind of ages them in that kind of time period.
Yeah, and plus, because it's set on the Channel Islands, a lot of people are, you know, it's a tax exile.
Yeah, that's where you're going to be there. You
know, there are a lot of rich people. Some amazing stories I came across when I went to the Channel Islands, because I went to this little island called Sark.
Yes.
Where there are no cars. It was like, you know, tractors and stuff and horses and things. It was like a weird, like, it's like going back to the 1950s. It's like a vision of cars.
They're not allowed cars, I think.
Cars. And so it's like this little, like, 1950s utopia. It's a bit like what I imagine people want, you know, post-Brexit UK to look like. And so the first thing I got to the island, there was this, like, the farmer who was, like, showing me around and stuff. And I was just, he thought I was just, like, a normal tourist. And I was asking questions like, where do you get the water from? How does the water supply come from? And he said, oh, we've got these wells and things. And I was like, where does the electricity come from? And he goes, well, you know, from the mainland. And I said, yeah, but how? And he's like, there's this great big cable going under the sea. And I said, where's the power station? And he took me to the power station. It was full of barrels of, like, diesel. It was, like, so old-fashioned. And I said, your island is powered by diesel. There's no, like, solar panels or wind turbines or anything. It was, like, so old-fashioned. But I thought to myself, in a weird way, if something really bad did happen to the world,
that's where I want
to
be. Yeah.
These guys would be quite self-sufficient. So
yeah,
hence the location, the fictional version of that island.
If you're stuck in the middle of London, you're done for.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's one thing I liked about the John Wyndham Day of the Triffids novel, which I don't think was really done in any other version. Maybe there was that BBC version where they had the plague, didn't they? Everyone was hiding out in London that could see. But all the blind people were dying, and then plague was starting out. So that forced them into the countryside, and that in the countryside is where the Triffids were. So they were kind of in between a rock and a hard place. I quite like that concept.
Yeah, there's is it The Survivors as well, which was a BBC TV series. Very good.
Yeah, that's right. It was for the middle class people eating pasta and stuff, wasn't it? not much really happened. When I was a kid, I used to watch The Survivors, thinking, "Oh, this is gonna be awesome. It's gonna be like zombie flesh eaters, Dawn of the Dead." But it was like nothing really happened. It was just lots of cooking.
There was a really good episode where they got rabies, and I remember that one fucking frightening the fuck out of me as a kid.
As a kid I was terrified of rabies, because that's all you heard in the 70s and early 80s, wasn't it? Rabies.
Yeah,
wasn't there a
nuclear war?
Hardcore version of Threads, that TV
series. Oh, yeah, Threads.
That was a lot worse. Yeah.
That fucked me up, that one.
Yeah, Chris Weston sent me his sketchbook this week, because we're kind of friends, and I was looking through it, and he had a big drawing of a traffic warden from Threads. But all the memories of that, pretty brutal.
But for people who don't remember the late 70s and early 80s, we were taught that there was going to be a nuclear war at school, and you were taught how to make a bomb shelter out of your bed and stuff like that, weren't you? You know, and what happens when the bomb goes off. It's fucking
hilarious.
You know.
On YouTube, we can watch the kind of what to do when there's a nuclear war, like putting doors up against like the wall. That was fuck all.
It's really naive information, isn't it? Just so the government think that, you know, people think the government's giving them some advice to help them, and in reality they're all going to die. Do you remember those public broadcast things in the 70s that were about not playing on building sites or quarries and things?
Yeah. fucking fight.
Yeah, well, really, really brutal.
Yeah. I have to say, I spent some time in the Channel Islands, and most of what I saw that scared me was a lot of very tough women fighting with each other. And with a lot of tattoos, and that was before sort of tattoos were trendy, you know.
Yeah. Well, they have a lot of drugs and stuff coming through the Channel Islands.
Oh right, okay.
I remember going to a little restaurant on Sark, and on the toilet doors were like leaflets about, you know, drugs and stuff. I was thinking drugs and the little 1950s utopian island, drugs and things. But yeah, they come through on the boats and things. And.
And which is a really posh one? Is it Alderney? Alderney's where all the posh people are.
Jersey's the poshest one. Yeah, Alderney, I think, used to be a concentration camp in
World
War
II. Oh, wow, did it? Okay.
Yeah, because that's another reason why I said it on the Channel Islands, partly is because when I went there, I discovered that the Nazi Germany conquered the Channel Islands in World War II. So it was like the little bit of Britain they owned. And and Hitler wanted to build this thing called the Atlantic Wall because he thought the... Allies would try to reclaim the Channel Islands as a prestige thing, but they didn't. They kind of left the islanders, you know, to their own devices, which was causing consternation. But Hitler built these massive concrete walls around some of the islands, like fortifications, like some out of the Pacific Rim. So again, I thought, if you're going to have these kind of sea monsters and coming out of the sea, you want to have some concrete defenses. I didn't really go to town too much on the comic with that. I paid a little bit of service to it with the bunker and things that the survivalist father kind of.
Because I know if you go to Guernsey, there's a war memorial and it's got German names as well as English names on it.
That's right, yes.
Yeah, and a lot of times they're crossed out with paint. People run into town at night, cross them out with red paint and stuff like that. I remember being at a party in, I think it was Jersey, and saying to someone, this bloke looked exactly like Hair Flick from Hello, Hello.
Yeah.
And I said, I was a bit drunk. And I said, you look a bit German. And it fucking almost kicked off.
Really? Oh, yeah. Fuck.
I didn't think it was an insult.
Well, my girlfriend's German, and so going to the Channel Islands, I was joking about, you know, just keep it, don't speak too much, you know,
don't
work on the accent a bit, you know, all lies.
That's genius. Yeah,
I think the weirdest thing I found out about the Channel Islands, though, which someone could turn it into an amazing comic, is. There's a pair of like billionaires who bought a bit of land, a little island just off Sark called the Barclay Brothers.
Oh, okay.
They're not related to the bank, but they're like these multi-billionaires, incredibly powerful people. But they're twin brothers who have never married, don't have any children, and they live on a secluded island, and they built this massive like castle.
Right.
And they own the airspace above the island, so no one's allowed to fly over their island. And they were trying to basically, they were trying to like buy out Sark, the island, so they could own it. And there was all these rumors about them and these the kind of shadow, almost like vampiric figures living in their on a little island with this castle. It was amazing. I thought that would make a brilliant story.
Oh, yeah. We've got to go there.
Someone's going to steal it now, aren't they? They're telling
it's true.
So how did you, because I think you pitched this at Kapow, did you? Is that right, John?
That's right, yeah.
How did that come about?
How did that come about? Well, I'd already written and drawn like a demo comic about 10 years before Kapow. I don't know if people know this, but I used to work in video games for a couple of decades in various roles. And I'd always wanted to kind of do a comic, write a comic, draw a comic. And I tried to leave the game industry for a number of times, and every time I walked into my boss's office and said I'm thinking of moving on, they'd always tempt me back with some other kind of project or a deal or something to make me stay. And I was kind of okay. And so I'd already written and drawn this demo comic in my spare time, and I'd shown it to some publishers in the US, and they really liked it, even though it needed a lot of work. It was quite rough and ready. And then I went to Kapow, and I thought, I'll take it with me and show it to some publishers. And the first publisher I showed it to was Titan, and it was Steve White, who was the commissioning editor at the time. And he really liked the sort of demo comic that I'd written, and asked me if I had any pitches for other ideas for Titan.
Okay.
And I pitched Surface Tension to them, and he liked it. And it went from there, really. So it was surprisingly easy, although I have to say actually making a comic wasn't so easy, because a lot of people think they can make a comic, write and draw a comic, especially from the games industry, because they do concept art and stuff, but it's a whole different language in terms of storytelling, you know, that you know, in terms of learning about how time flows across panels. And
Did you find that you had to sort of, in some ways, reset your brain to start?
Yeah, completely. Absolutely, completely. You know, I would honestly say, it's no exaggeration, that writing and drawing and colouring a comic was the hardest amount of work I'd ever done, even in games. In games, you do a lot of crunch time, a lot of really long hours. But I think a comic, in a way, because you're doing a lot on your own, in a games team, you can rely on other people. You can kind of almost hide a bit within a team. But when you're doing a comic, you know, people look at your artwork. It's your artwork most of the time. And, you know, if there are problems with it, you know, they're your problems. There's no hiding them.
Yeah.
And, it was...
If your artwork, you know, is stellar, if the story's not good enough to sit with it, people will pick that up, won't they?
And also, you have, like, Titan said to me, I sent my script through, which is basically a treatment, and you break the treatment down into page numbers, so you know all the pages. And the original treatment for Surface Tension was about 12 US, typical US sized issues.
Wow. Okay.
And they said, oh, we like it, but there's no way for a first time writer artist, we're going to take a gamble on a 12 issue miniseries. It's just not, because at the end of the day, it comes down to economics like anything else. And they said, you have to cut it down by 50%. So I was like, ooh, 50%, ooh. So I had to rewrite it. And even that is an art in itself, is
definitely
rewriting a script, cutting it down, trying to keep all the valuable information, but
so
also
you had
compressing
the whole thing then as 12 issues, is that?
Yes, yeah. And then I had to cut it down by 50%.
Must have broken your heart a little bit, because that's like, you've done it, you've written it, and you think, oh, fuck me, I've got to write it again, almost.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. You don't get paid for that work, you know, creative owned, as you guys know, you know, it's all out of your own pocket. It was a big rewrite time, but it taught me a lot of lessons. In a way, you want someone to say to you, no, that's not good enough, or no, it needs cutting down, because it kind of teaches you discipline. Otherwise, you're just really undisciplined, and without someone giving you a goal or a deadline or telling you this, you know, the problem with a lot of artists and writers and people like us is we may never finish it, because you're just always wanting to redo that panel or redraw that face.
Okay.
So yeah, it was quite good being told that. So even though, you said, it did break my heart because I cut some things out that I really liked. But I said to Titan, I said to my editor, Andrew James, I said, okay, I'm going to cut this down. Totally agree. But is there any possibility that some of the cut scenes will end up back into the trade collection? And they said, sure. So I got to add scenes that were cut, some of the scenes, not all of them, that I put back in for the trade release.
Oh, cool.
No, so that was quite nice. Yeah.
How did you find the... because this is pretty much your first comic, is it?
Yes, it's totally first comic.
How did you find working...
Bastard.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, but it does have problems, though. I do think that because of the nature of cutting it all down, there's like... being brutally honest about my own work here, there's some scenes that are just too expositional heavy.
Really?
I think with narratives, you watch a film and they say it's a bit too plot heavy, or it's a bit, or it's more about tone. I think with Surface Tension, there were some areas that became too plot heavy and unbalanced the drama sometimes. That was one lesson.
You've got to cut 50% of the material. I guess some sequences are going to be a bit more kind of exposition heavy than you'd like.
Yeah. I think, you know, if I was more experienced, I'm sure I'd find better ways to say more without, you know, with saying less, you know, if you know what I mean.
You got to be cruel to be kind when that you know, suddenly hits you that you've got to cut half of it out, you know.
Yeah.
Yes. You really have to be, I suppose. Yeah. Okay, so how did you find dealing with an editor and that sort of thing? Because was it a new experience for you in that sort of editor-creator relationship, was it?
Yeah, really new experience, because I'd written scripts before in for the games industry. What normally happens there is I'd write the script and then work with a professional writer to polish it up. But writing scripts for the games is very different from comics, because in games it's an interactive, you know... you're playing a game and players are doing different things, so it's not like a linear narrative a movie or a comic, because the player might do something. So you got to kind of write script dialogue depending on outcomes of how a player play a game. So it's a very that's a different art to writing a script for a comic. So working with an editor was interesting because they can polish some of your dialogue still. So I sometimes had a tendency to overwrite scenes, an Andrew would say something, and maybe you could say it in this way, you know, if you thought about approaching it from this angle and stuff. So there was a lot of bouncing around, which I really appreciated. And so, you know, he helped craft some lines of dialogue that maybe I potentially struggled over. Or asked his advice, like, what do you think this... I'm trying to say this, you know, how can
does
I...
Does it come across? It?
Yeah, how can I enunciate it in a way that it flows better for a comic? Right. So, you know, I couldn't say anything bad about that process, really. It was really, really, really helpful. And I know these editors, you know, you learn from working with editors that, you know, they're editing about, you know, 10 books a month in some cases. And these are books that are, you know, going to bring them in a lot more revenue than a creator-owned thing, you know, especially the licensed material. You can imagine these guys work hard.
Yeah, I was saying, you can imagine the phone call from Steve White into the editor going, right, I've got a job for you. First off, have you ever done LSD? you might want to start and then have a read of this script. Yeah, can you imagine this? Because it's such a, I don't want to say strange, it's such an unusual story, isn't it? And I like that. I think we need to live in the unusual. And it's such an unusual approach that you need a good editor to be in sync with you and know where you're coming from, and then to craft on that, you know?
That is really, really important. I mean, I do try to, when I'm working with other people, I do try to kind of give them some examples of where I am in terms of tone and style. And if they know those other reference points, they can get where you're coming from. You know, there's some things that I like, but I would never want to write because I just know I won't be very good at it. So I write the things that I enjoy whilst trying to make them different. You know, I love, like, you know, we talked about zombies earlier. I love the zombie genre, but I didn't want to make just another, you know, horror comic. Yeah. You know, I love things like Crossed and things like that, or some of Crossed actually crosses the line. I love horror, but I didn't want to make just another wannabe zombie comic. So you tell the editor, you say, okay, I'm more in the area of a kind of this, that, and the other, and they go, yeah, I get what you mean, and then so you're good to go. Because you have to have that common ground.
We're definitely hitting zombie fatigue at the moment. I heard someone pitching a zombie comic, and I was like, it's got to be something really different to kind of stand
definitely.
Out.
I remember a long, long, long time ago, there was an interview with Jackie Chan. I used to love Jackie Chan. I remember when they were looking for the next Bruce Lee, when Bruce Lee died, and they go, okay, we need another martial arts star, and there's all these different Bruce Lee's coming out of the woodwork, you know, Bruce Lu, and all the kind of things.
Yeah, names, Bronson, you know, Lee is my favourite.
Bronson Lee, yeah, exactly. Yeah. and Jackie Chan, you know, tried to, you know, get his break at that point, but he said, okay, you know, I want to be the next amazing martial arts star, but, you know, I'm not going to be Bruce Lee. You know, Bruce Lee does serious fights, I'm going to do comedy fights. You know, Bruce Lee, you know, is all about punching, I'm going to be about kicking. So, you know, he was still working in the martial arts genre, but he was doing the flip side of what the most popular thing was. And I think that's sometimes how you have to approach something where you feel it's popular and you like that genre, but how can you put your spin on it? So with Surface Tension, I thought, okay, it's like, you know, Titan might say it's like The Walking Dead, but my version of The Walking Dead, okay, it's really bright and sunny and there's nature and people are trying to help each other, but you don't want to make it boring and twee. So I'll go for the weirdness and that kind of thing and try to make it a bit more positive.
If you hadn't mentioned The Walking Dead in reference to it, I wouldn't have made that connection whatsoever. No. I don't see The Walking
more
Dead
than that,
in it.
Isn't it?
There's no kind of zombie element apart from the kind of initial, the seasickness.
I think if there's any kind of Walking Dead connection you could make, it's because it's more about like people and characters. You know, you've got the horror and the fantastical element about it. But it is these human interactions that make this story.
I mean, one other thing, they feel like these real people and against like an issue or a problem that could absolutely just crush the world and roll over them in an instant. And that really comes across in the book. That
thanks. I kind of wanted to make these characters a little bit sort of flawed as well, in a way. You have the two protagonists that kind of cause this, you know, global issue are two environmentalists called Eric and Megumi, and Eric is the kind of positive, I want to help the world, you know, I want to save it, you know, we all know these kind of characters where they go a bit too overboard, you know, those people who, you know, dig up bodies from, you know, graves because they worked in, you know, animal laboratories or something, and you know, so they go that extreme thing. But then you also have the people who just lost faith in humanity, and people go, oh, yeah, we just better off, you know, being wiped out because we're just causing all these problems and blah, blah, blah. So I wanted to have those two voices that were in a relationship bouncing off each other. So the guy who wants to save the world ends up destroying it, and the woman who, you know, has lost faith in mankind happens to be the one that could, you know, save it. So I wanted to kind of flip those two views on their head in a way to create this kind of dynamism between them.
There's a lot of concepts and ideas going on, and I know you said you had like the demo comic, as it were. How long was surface tension in your head before you actually created it?
Notions of it were bouncing around in my head for quite a few years. Mostly because, like I said, you know, when I was a kid going on holiday by the coast, I used to, you know, read things like Guy N. Smith, you know, those giant crab novels and stuff.
Oh God, I like them. I read one recently.
I used to love them. Yeah. In fact, I'm looking at a few on the shelf right now. I can see.
Yeah, they're great. Yeah. Was it Blood Moon of the Crabs and all that?
Yeah.
Right.
I think Charlie Adlard actually drew a comic based on those books.
I didn't know that. I must find that.
Check it out. And so I had that world, like that world, really roughly, you know, bouncing around in my head. And when I did that demo comic, it was like a rough rehearsal for Surface Tension. It was very different, but it had some of the vaguely basic ideas. That was about, you know, 10 years or so ago. So it already been in there. I was always terrified that someone would do something very similar. When you're writing a comic,
I wouldn't worry about
thinking,
that.
Oh, like someone's going to announce. Someone's going to announce the same story any day now. And,
yeah, yeah. I don't think you should worry about that at all. I've got to tell you.
No. I remember on an earlier podcast you were talking about how you would still read something even if it had a similar, you know,
definitely
a similar idea to something else, because people have very different takes. It happened in Hollywood a lot, doesn't you? Get two asteroid films at once, or
yeah, you do, don't you? Yeah.
That doesn't mean that one's better than the other. They're just different flavors, aren't they? You know.
Yeah, and also it's just that zeitgeist thing happens, doesn't it? Because we all watch the same news programs. We all share the same hive mind, aren't we?
Exactly.
There's going to be a million, you know, Trump satire comics coming out soon.
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
Although
there's
going to
be a million stories of giant fucking fish attacking people any minute. Although I would quite happily give a fiver to anyone who in any way tried to replicate what you've done here, dude. Because I can see that this must have taken you a long time to do, though, mustn't it?
Yeah.
How long did it take you?
It took about 2 years, which is
too long, really.
Yeah.
Did you get to a point you thought, oh, fuck me, perhaps I should just do a comic about two people talking about their problems in a flat?
Yeah.
Do you know, sometimes I do look at other comic books and think I could, yeah, make my life a lot easier.
Yeah.
Especially since my missus will go to like some kind of crafts fair market or something, and she'll buy like, you know, calendars of animals, and these like just be like matchstick animals, like, you know, balls with legs, and it was like a cat. And it's like, oh, look, cute cat. And I go, yeah, that bastard's probably making loads of money. And these little, you know, the scribble drawings of cats and dogs and stuff. You know, that's probably the way to do it.
That took him 10 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's great. I mean, I love the fact that it's not safe. I think that's, you know, an admirer of yours, because it's not a safe book, is it? Do you think that, was there ever a wobble by Titan thinking, oh, we're putting a lot of money and effort into this book that's basically completely out there, and we wonder whether people will get it?
You'd have to ask those guys, really.
Right, okay.
I think that I never saw it as really weird. I think probably because a lot of things that I watch or read are like really, really weird. You know,
yeah.
Crazy stuff.
He has a shelf of crabs books. I think that's
Yeah, exactly. You know, when you're grown up with Guy N. Smith and, you know, all that kind of weird craziness.
Yeah.
Or even, you know, some like Japanese movies and.
Yeah, there's a huge anime influence, surely there is there, or...
Yeah, there's definitely a Japanese influence, definitely.
Yeah.
But you still want to relate it to, you know, your home audience, don't you?
Yeah.
You know, you want to take the weirdness, but try to make... Because if I read, like, a comic and stuff and it's just crazy weird, I do like it. But for me personally, I want to kind of ground the... You know, weirdness is normally, for me, weirder when it's grounded in, reality.
Yeah, The fact it's British is a huge, huge touchstone for me on this book.
Yeah, you know, sometimes people, they get scared when, you know, when it's Britain. You know, sometimes I feel like some publishers kind of almost like potentially might be worried that something's set in Britain. Certainly it was true in the games industry. You know, if you want to set a game in Britain, it was like, oh, no way, Britain doesn't sell outside of Britain, you know, because everyone looks at the US for, you know, their...
Trouble is, I always see when a story's set in the US, for me, it always comes across as like a kind of fairy tale. It's in America, and it can kind of be written off as like it's a story, but like you say, when you kind of get it a little closer to home. It's a bit
For me, it's like
I'm not sure if Americans
later.
Feel that way.
Yeah, definitely.
It's like 28 days later when he's walking through Parliament Square and you think, fuck, you know, I walked through there 2 days ago.
Exactly.
You
know, it's like Threads again. You know, when I watched Threads, I used to live in Doncaster, which is right next to Sheffield. So I knew Sheffield really well, and then seeing Sheffield being blown up, I don't know that much different, you know, before or after. But, you know. But it still meant I could relate to it. And I think that sometimes in the UK, you know, a lot of people, not necessarily in comics necessarily, but they look to America as their, you know, marketplace and forget that to a lot of Americans, the UK is kind of exotic and quite quirky and they like that, you know. There's a reason why Harry Potter's, you know, successful in the US, partly because it's like a family film, but also, you know, they quite like
trade on
that,
doesn't it?
Yeah. I was really surprised. I got quite a few Japanese friends in Japan, and they told me that something like, remember the film Brassed Off?
Yeah.
Sheffield Brass Band. But it's really famous in Japan. because to them, it's like this kind of strange, like exotic world of brass bands and things.
It's a real cultural kind of touch point, something we'd kind of be quite familiar with in a different culture. Be like, well, we've never had been shown this before.
Exactly.
Terrible series that was Benny Hill being popular in America.
Yeah, it's true.
Terrible, but they seem to like it, didn't they?
It's true. Wasn't Michael Jackson a big fan of Benny Hill?
I think, well, that tells a story, didn't it?
There was a program on, like, it was all right in the 80s or something, and they did a Benny Hill joke on that. And I was like, holy fuck. It was just so brutal. I was like,
there's a reason that doesn't get repeated, isn't there?
Yeah.
That, like, is it Mind Your Language? Do you remember Mind Your Language of the class full of sort of just cliche, racist cliches of
dodgy times.
Yeah,
and then there's a whole. I think, go on.
No, I think ITV knew it because they kept running it because it was so popular. Yeah,
fucking hell.
Yeah. Well, that's a crazy thing, isn't it? When we grew up, there was like so much, like, you know, just anything went almost different to now. Everyone goes crazy on Twitter if anything vaguely, you know, hints at.
Yeah,
they're like Curry and Pepper. Fucking Spike Milligan was blacking up.
Oh yeah!
So Jesus Christ!
Yeah.
Mental.
Have you ever
seen
the Spike Milligan Dalek comedy?
Yeah, the Pakistan Dalek.
Oh my God! Fucking hell! I mean, that used to get trotted out at Doctor Who conventions occasionally, and like, oh my God!
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Jesus.
Did you go to many Doctor Who conventions, Tony?
Well, to a few, mate. Yeah, but that was back when it was cool. Well, not really. It wasn't full of screaming David Tennant fans back then. It was full of just old blokes. A bit like a 2000 AD festival.
Did David Tennant fans just scream then?
They just scream, isn't they?
Yeah.
But there's two different fans. There's new Doctor Who and old Doctor Who in there.
Yeah, I used to really like the Doctor Who of the, when it was really, again, like, probably quite bad for kids, and it was the really horror Doctor early Tom Baker.
Like Talents of Wong Chiang.
Yeah, people being stabbed and ventriloquist dummies coming to life. You know, as a kid, it was like, bloody hell.
Still frightens me now. Yeah.
Totally different to Doctor Who now. You know.
What's that one where the bloke turns into a plant? Is it the Seeds of Doom or something like
Seeds
that?
Seeds of Doom, yeah. The crinoids. That had a little bit of an influence on surface tension, actually.
Yeah, I was about to say that. Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, that fucked me up. Something rotten when I watched that. Yeah. And that was on at like 6:30 on a Saturday.
Yeah. Most terrifying one for me was the Bertie Bassett from the Sylvester.
That frightened you, didn't it?
Didn't he melt people and turn them into sweets or something?
Yeah, and they killed him because they melted his feet and he stuck to the floor, didn't they? Because he's got sugar on his feet.
I was reading a bit about that. They basically couldn't ever use that character again because of the sweet company.
Oh, right, okay.
They said, like, they got in touch, like, solicitors and said, look, we'll let it fly, but you're not to use this character ever again.
So you've got to murder him.
Yeah, you know, like, licorice. What's the licorice?
Bertie Bassett.
Bertie Bassett. It's too similar to him.
I think what a lot of people forget, though, nowadays is, like, kids love that kind of stuff.
Yeah, they do, yeah.
Sometimes I used to do little talks at schools about how to get into games and things. And then you ask the kid, you go, have you got any questions? And they go, oh, yeah, what's the most violent game you've ever played? You know, I was supposed to be doing, like, a little talk to, and there's teachers there, and, you know, these kids are, like, you know, 12 years old. And they're asking me questions about Grand Theft Auto and Call of Duty. And I showed them some images of games I've worked on. It was like this, I remember the one game I worked on was... I had this little boy who drowned in a swamp in Louisiana, and his body gets eaten by a crocodile, and his ghost haunts the crocodile, so this crocodile's possessed by the spirit of this little boy, And then in the game, the crocodile vomits up the remains of this drowned boy and becomes this puke monster that uses the body of the crocodile as a weapon. So, yeah, you've got to go with that.
And then, social tension's making a bit more sense now. It's all coming together, isn't it, really?
Yeah. But you say that to kids, and like, wow. That's the best thing ever.
Yeah.
So, the old Doctor Who in the 70s, towns of Wang Chiang and people turning into plants and stuff. Yeah, kids love that stuff. I think nowadays we get a bit too much, it's going to scare kids, give them nightmares and things. But, that altered that idea as well. That was
exactly.
Action comics.
Yeah, I remember it frightening me as a kid. I have to say, the perfect time to read Surface Tension, and I'll probably get into this a bit later and thank a few people, but is when you're on morphine. I read it, I had quite a bit of an operation this week, and I read it whilst I was on morphine, and it's fucking, oh my God. That's why I had to reread it today. I don't know which bits I'd hallucinated and which bits are real. And I've got to say, all of it is what I thought I'd hallucinated, and it's all in the book, so there you go.
Yeah. Is it really that weird? Wow.
I think because you have such a visual style that's sort of out there, and just the creature designs. Which brings me to your artistic work process, because there's a crazy amount of detail that goes on, and the facial expressions and everything. How do you work? Is it all... do you work do separate panels and then put them together? Is it an entire page at a time, or is it digital?
It's a mixture of all those things you just mentioned. I mostly draw separate panels because they're a bit too detailed, to be honest. I need to cut down on that stuff. Mm. And they're usually, a lot of the time, not always, they're penciled and then scanned, and then I boost the pencil contrast in Photoshop so it looks it gets blacker and contrasty. And then sometimes if I'm not happy the way it's drawn, I'll kind of touch it up, in Photoshop just to make sure it looks, okay. And obviously all the colours done digital. The first half of the book was mostly done with pencils and scanned, and then I went more and more digital as the book went on, as I was trying to get better at doing digital inks and things. So I don't even notice it, but I noticed there's a shift.
No, I don't notice a change at all. No.
Is that purely because just a learning process, or was it speed?
I was always trying to find a way of how to speed up the process, and to be honest, I don't find there's any difference to if I draw some panels digitally or if I draw them with pencil. They still seem to take me the same amount of laborious time. I don't feel any speed up or shortcuts with going digital. And in fact, sometimes digital can slow you down because you can zoom in and add more detail.
True.
When the book is printed, some of that detail gets lost.
What scale do you work to then?
Normally I draw panels on A3 pages and scan them in, sometimes A4. It's quite hard to know what scale I work at because it's all cut up and scanned in bits and pieces. So it's hard.
That's pretty much the way I work too. Like I do elements.
Yeah.
I never draw a whole page.
I don't feel confident enough to draw a whole page, funny enough. You were talking about when you went to the 2000E event last week, and you saw artists like Chris Weston with his full pages that look like the printouts, but the original art. I feel like, I don't know if you're the same, but I feel almost like terrified to draw a full page. So I draw it in panels, because if I make a mistake, it's not so bad.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, but also, I do the full page stuff, and as soon as it's normally like the inset panels. Like when you draw in the close-up of a hand or like some kind of action. And if you slightly get that wrong, you just can't stop looking at it.
Exactly.
But I mean, then you, that's when I step in and do what you guys do. I just draw that individual panel and then replace it in Photoshop. That's the beauty.
Yeah, you can also tweak a composition if you've got different separate elements. You can tweak it in Photoshop a little easier than that's just a bit too much time playing around time. And there's pros and cons, I feel. But,
definitely pros and cons. You can definitely fiddle too much with Photoshop or whatever.
I don't think there's a right way. I don't think you can honestly say digital is the way to go or completely original pages. I think find whatever works best for you.
Absolutely, definitely. I've heard some people there at conventions like really diss digital stuff, and I don't understand it. They go, oh, it's not proper art, it's not even it's digital.
I think it's a load of fucking bollocks. I mean, it is a shame because you don't get a chance to see those original pages. That's the shame of it. I think some people find that some digital artworks a little too clean. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I'm trying to almost get away from that myself, you know. For the next thing I'm working on, trying to make it, you know, just go back to like pencils and make it, but don't clean up the pencils so much, but leave them really rough looking.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think with digital stuff, the one thing I do find is you can lose some of that movement digitally because it goes too clean in a way.
Right. Yeah, I get you. Yeah, yeah. I was wondering, do you use face actors? Do you have actors for any of your...
No.
Use
face actors? Oh, yeah, yeah. Actually, I'll say no. I did have one or two friends that I vaguely used them as character, sort of like tried to capture a bit of their sort of face. But
right.
you have to change that a lot to make them more cartoonified.
Yeah.
But there was one or two people, yeah, definitely were based on people I know.
Okay, but you didn't say, "Oh, look surprised or look shocked or look scared."
No, okay. Maybe, I might have done one or two. Just open your mouth wide, because you know it's amazing when you look at people's faces. You know, when you're
where are we going with
there.
This? Sorry, hang on.
It's just amazing the little nuances of how far the nose from the upper lip is on different people's faces, or how the eyes how far apart. You know, it's amazing when you start really observing people's faces.
Because whenever I've done that in my work, I always end up. Like that character looks very similar to me. He shouldn't look like that.
My wife says that a lot when she looks at my work. She says I can always see your face in the drawing.
But you see that with a lot of artists, don't you?
Definitely,
a lot of artists,
yeah.
There's a little bit of something when you see them in real life. You can compare to their art, you know.
Definitely.
Yeah, definitely.
That dude that does the Britannica. With Slane.
Yeah, Slane's him, isn't it? Basically,
that's just the best. Then
it is.
Well, I think a lot of those guys that do like painterly art style and stuff, I think they probably do use a little photo reference and then paint into the photos and things. I certainly can spot it sometimes.
Yeah.
And the one thing you should never do with digital is take photographs and trace over them, because I spot that sometimes and it just looks the foreshortening in the perspective and the way the feet planted on the ground all look wrong because the lens of a camera distorts that stuff and you can spot it.
Even though
taking photo reference is still a good thing, because you get the basic dynamism of the movement and things like that.
I've done stuff, I guess you call it cheating, when I've drawn a hand like three times and I feel, oh fuck this, so I take a picture, put it in Photoshop and basically just like draw it from there and then just put it in and then colour it, because I'm so sick to death of trying to get like a hand holding a pen or doing something.
Oh, definitely.
You're having a bit of an off day, and it's, I'm going to shortcut this.
I think any artist who, unless you're just like, I don't know, the most amazing, amazing artist in the world, I think a lot of artists will take photographs of hands and feet and things and use them as reference. The classical artists, back in the day did it. You know, even before cameras, they'd have a model in their studio every day that they'd, paint from and, or projecting a light box onto the wall and use it for reference. So, never be afraid of doing things like that. I mean, one of the talks I do sometimes, once I've drawn the characters a lot, I'll reference back to the drawings of the characters from previous panels, because, at the end of the day, you've got to get this stuff out there.
Yeah.
You've got to get it in the shops or, online or whatever it is, whatever promises you've got to your readers, you've got to get it out there.
Yeah. How did you find the sort of publicity machine moving around it? Did you were you very much caught up on it, or did the company do it for you? Or so once you had the finished product and issue one was bound for the shops and in previews, what was the next move for you there?
Do you know what? Because I was so new to comics in terms of doing it myself, even though I buy a lot of comics, I had no idea. Seriously, I had no idea. I didn't really know how you got tables at comic cons and stuff.
Right.
I didn't know how much publicity you're supposed to do yourself, how much Titan would do. I just had no previous experience of doing that. And, Titan, the good thing about going through something like a publisher like Titan or any other, publisher like them is, they will get your book out there in terms of, getting it to reviewers and things like that.
Yeah.
But the one thing looking at other people's comics, I noticed other people's comics had quotes from famous people on the covers or, somewhere in their PR material, Neil Gaiman or whatever and things like that. And so I know that wasn't necessarily going to happen with me. So I went out and tried to ask people I already knew that I, had dealings with in the past, so people like Pat Mills when I was at when I was a game director, I would go to comic cons and get artists and writers in the comic industry to do work for Sony. Because I knew they'd be, you know, be paid quite well. And if I was looking for a script writer, I'd ask a comic writer if they'd be interested in, you know, doing a script polish. Or if I knew a comic artist at a show, I'd ask them if they'd be interested in doing storyboards and things like that. So I kind of got to know people in the comic industry through games. And I tried to work with Pat on a science fiction game when I was at Sony. It never happened. It didn't get through pre-production. But we had some meetings together and discussed, you know, bounced ideas around. And, yeah, I'm a massive fan of Pat Mills' work. So, you know, he was kind enough to give me a quote. So things like that, I underestimated how much work I would have to do versus the publisher. So you still got to get out there. And I have to say that selling a book is something I sometimes don't feel comfortable with. You know, when you go on something like Twitter, and you make friends with another writer or whatever, not necessarily in comics, but, you know, traditional prose publishing, and every day they seem to be pushing out their, you know, their adverts and stuff. And after a while, it gets a bit like,
You're not alone in thinking that. I mean, it's finding that fine balance. I mean, we said it on the show a few times that I think each one of us kind of has a problem with sort of pimping our own stuff because you have to do it.
I could pimp someone else's every day.
I think the US creators find it a lot easier than UK guys. From dealing with US and UK, the US guys are much more confident of that kind of thing. It's part of their culture, I think. And the UK culture is a bit more like, please, sir, can I just show you my comic?
I know, like, when a new episode of this show comes out, I have to go, oh, right, here comes the Facebook blast.
Yeah.
Where I just have to go onto the groups and the pages and just sort of say, check out this episode. And I feel like a shameless whore.
Oh, yeah, I hate it. But you've got to do it, though, haven't you? Because other people are doing it. You've got to do it. And as long as you're not like some of the people that, you know, I'm aware of that, every day they've got their, you know, advert on whatever media they use, I think you're okay. Because sometimes I follow other writers and artists, and I wish they did pimp their work more, because I want to see, you know, they're always like, you know, like all of us are usually grumbling about Trump or, you know, whatever. And sometimes I think, I wish you just pimp your work a bit more, because I want to see your work.
Conversely, you do get the person who will go, you know, they'll be talking about one thing and they go, oh, by the way, this is very similar to my book called The, you know, and you're like, oh, fuck me, not again, mate, really? Yeah,
exactly.
It's like, yeah, there are a few people out there who are a little bit shameless. Yeah, we talk
about when I first joined Twitter, I had this really weird moment, and this writer, you know, followed my thing, and so I followed him back, and then you got into all those crazy rules as well. You know, follow me, I won't follow you, kind of rubbish. And I hate that shit. Crap.
Yeah.
But I started getting these questions from this other writer about my work, and I was replying to him, and then I suddenly worked out it was a script. And he had some, and it basically, this script work, he asks you questions about your comic or whatever, but it's like a binary script. And then eventually, if you send the replies, it will start pimping their book.
Oh, fuck me.
Wow, that's amazing. And I just instantly, like, unfollowed them, because I thought that
everyone's
was
a robot. Everyone's a robot.
There's a robot script on his behalf to pimp his book. It's like, that's just outrageous.
That's outrageous.
Where do we get this program from?
I know. Yeah,
that was really bad.
I did think that. I do wonder, how do you get thousands and thousands of followers? Wow, it's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
So that kind of thing, You've still got to sell your own work, you've still got to get out there. Yeah, this is the first comics podcast I've done, for example. So.
Okay.
Oh, that's great.
We've popped his cherry.
Woo! Exactly.
So, but I suppose Tyne will have handled a lot of that for you, weren't that, at the time?
Tyne got the book out to, you know, reviewers and things, and things people I wasn't even aware of. So, you know, they did a brilliant job in that respect.
Right.
But I mentioned earlier, it is... You know, it's an industry that is saturated with, you know, books and, you know, this, that, the other. And it's a bit like in the movie industry or in the games industry, that you have your big hitters, you know, your Call of Duty's, Grand Theft Auto's, or in the movies, you've got your Marvel movies and the Star Wars franchise and so forth. And then you've got your super, 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 super indie niche, almost like hipster films or games or even comics, I guess. Yeah, even comics, definitely comics. There are definitely quite a few hipster comics I'm aware of. And those two seem to dominate. So you've got your shops, you know, like Gosh is an amazing shop, but it has a lot of the really quirky boutique comics. Mm. Yeah, and then you've got your FP, which is full of your big, you know, super mainstream stuff.
Yeah,
so if you're doing something like my stuff, you just get lost in the middle somewhere. Yeah, you're squeezed out. So it's quite hard sometimes to get the attention you're kind of trying to look for just to survive, in a sense. Mm-hmm. It's not like an egotistical attention, but you know, you want to make another book, so you want to get your work out there in order to get another deal and stuff.
Mm. But your book kind of crosses over a bit for me. You know, I could easily see your book on the shelves at Forbidden Planet, but then again, I think it would appeal, because it's got a real edge to it, I can see it appealing to the horror crowd, I can see it appealing to sort of indie comics crowd. You know, and you're certainly Marvel and DC. I can see this. You know, I can see this as a Vertigo book. Mm. You know, easily. You know.
Yeah. I think so. I think people may just be. They may just glance at that cover and think it's another zombie book.
Yeah.
I think that's you know, hand on heart. I think that obviously will appeal to some people, but for some people,
but when the artist edition comes out, you can do a bigger.
Well, the one thing I did. I don't know what my publisher thought of this, but sometimes when I do cons, I do create a different cover.
Oh, nice.
Just because I was very aware of the audience that was building up for Surface Tension, and I thought I want to make a cover that appeals to that audience. Now, if I sell prints at Thought Bubble, you're aware of the cover that sells the most, and the cover, the print that sold the most was the one with the lady sitting on the hill with the masked figure behind her. I sold loads of that print. And I thought that's the audience that likes that book. Is they're looking for the weirdo Japanese stuff. They like a bit of horror, but they want the mystery element as well. They're not looking
or
for
just a beautiful image,
things.
Dude. Yeah, you know, or even a, you know, something they can see on a wall, and that's something, you know. I certainly True. Get that framed. Mm. Yeah.
I mean, have you had any people, now that this is out and, like, you know, people are reading it? Have you had people approaching you about collaborations and stuff? I mean, you strike me as a creator who's very much creator owned, you know, it's your stories and your ideas, but have you had many people come up to you and sort of say, I'd love to work with you on something?
But weirdly enough, not actually. No, one or two people, but not that many. The only thing that did happen is it got approached for film and TV. I think it was the first day the first issue came out. Dark Horse, I could probably say this now because it's a while ago now, but Dark Horse Films approached me to work on a TV TV show based on it.
Wow.
It's you feel like it's amazing to begin with, but it's a really and it is amazing, but it's a really protracted,
it's a long road
process. And you have all these meetings and all the cliches that you hear about, you know, US TV, you know, start to happen, and, you know, can we set it in America? You know, can it have this? Can it have that?
Can they turn into fish if they get angry? That kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so you're aware that, you know, you just cannot be precious about it. But those wheels move really slowly.
Hmm. Yeah,
It was interesting. It was fascinating. You know, hearing their take on it.
Yeah.
And then you're very aware that they're looking just for something which is a zeitgeist. And I think with Surface Tension, it was the whole refugee crisis thing.
Yeah,
you know, people going into the sea and, you know, coming ashore and that kind of stuff. And they wanted to have something that keyed into that kind of imagery. And I guess they looked through things and saw that cover of Surface Tension, which is obviously, in that respect, it was a good thing because it brought it to their attention. They wanted to, you know, had a very different take on the material. And then
take a long time. I'm a big Bendis fan, and having listened to him for like 10 years on Word Balloon. He's been talking about the Powers TV series for donkey's years. He had a bit of a missed start, and then I actually finally watched it yesterday. And I actually quite liked the first season, but that took so long to get done, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
And then once it could go on for ages, or it could, you know, six episodes and it's done. And
the US system's even worse. Even worse than the US. They do a pilot episode, and the pilot episode doesn't fly you.
That money and effort that goes into that pilot episode, and then nothing happens to it. Yeah, incredible, isn't it? Yeah.
So you just can't take that. I mean, it's great, but you cannot take that stuff seriously. It's great. I use it as a bit of, you know, publicity, but
you've got to balance that with spending the time on the new projects, on what you're working on next. I will say, in terms of your artwork, I don't know whether you'll like the character or anything. But if you don't do, and I'm saying this, I don't know if anyone from Marvel's listening, if there's not a Doctor Strange issue with you doing the artwork for it, it's a bloody crime.
That would be fantastic.
Yeah, that'd be really good.
Yeah.
I thought it was like, I thought you were going to say Swamp Thing for a second.
Oh, yeah.
SpongeBob SquarePants. Definitely. SpongeBob SquarePants.
Yeah, that's the one I'd like to do. Definitely. That's the weird thing, because, you know, sometimes you go to conventions and you see, well, you guys go a lot more than I do, but sometimes you go there and you see, like, all the, you know, some people just capitalize on fan art and they got all the, you know, prints of Darth Vader or Star Wars and stuff. Yeah. I always think, yeah, if I did that stuff, I'd go for probably the most niche fan art possible. Some obscure, weird Italian movie that no one's seen. You know? Why is no one buying it?
Yeah. Man Thing on the Channel Islands, though, there's definitely a pitch there somewhere. There's enough weirdness going on there. Awesome. It's like the our bio, isn't it? You know, sort of.
Yeah. Man Thing turns up at there's Barclay Brothers' house.
Like, a surface tension SpongeBob. Oh, my life. That'd be amazing.
But to be honest, I kind of want to try to stick to my own stuff as long as possible.
It's very
difficult, but
yeah.
When I read that, I kind of I'd imagine you wouldn't get too many approaches because you come across as the creator who does want to do his own stuff. You've got your own voice. Yeah, well, I would have thought, like, kind of, you've got this, surface tension's great, the art's great, the writing's great. Why would you need to work with someone else because you got all the bases covered?
Yeah, I would like to work with another artist, though. I do have some ideas for the stories, and because it takes me so long to do these books, it's a very, you live a very frugal life. You know, I think you guys have probably got, you know, day jobs and stuff, and you do your comics in the spare time, so it's a long slog, isn't it? So, you know, you have to keep bringing money in order to make these books. So, yeah, I am aware that I can't do everything myself, so... it's, you know, picking your battles, so to speak.
Yeah, cool.
Without spoiling anything, then, you're working on your next project, I take it. Is it a definite, something completely different from Surface Tension? You're making a concerted effort to step in a different direction?
Yeah, it's completely different. I wasn't really interested in doing, like, long-running, you know, comic. I wanted to move on quite quickly. I think because I come from that, as we all do, I come from that background of sort of British TV, where they had, like, you know, your miniseries, that's it, it's done. It's not like a 4 or 5 year long, you know, as long as you got viewers sort of approach. So I did have an idea for a sequel to Surface Tension, because obviously the book ends on a bit of a, you know, I won't say too much about the ending, but it ends on a, you know, it could continue. And I did want to, the second one I was going to make, it was going to be a bit more of a sort of a Mad Max Fury Road sequel to Surface Tension. But I'm working on something, you know, completely different. You know, I guess it still looks like my kind of style, but it's a bit more. I showed Dan a quick image today. It's much more sort of looser.
And it's great.
Thank you. Again, it's set in Britain in the 1980s, and I come from a background that's incredibly sort of, you know, what, you know, I hate, it's a horrible term, isn't it? But sort of working class. My dad was a coal miner. So it was a miner during the miner strike in the '80s, and so it's a sort of vaguely, you know, very vaguely sort of autobiographical. And the one thing I was really keenly aware of during the sort of miner strike was, you know, when I was a kid at that time, I was obsessed with video games because the home computer had just started to sort of come popular and mainstream. So I was obsessed with, you know, playing Manic Miner and Jessup Willie and that kind of stuff. And my dad was out on strike, you know, on picket lines and stuff. And, you know, we were living off charity and you know, Oxfam clothes and things like that. And I was always dreaming of making video games. So I want to tell a story in that time. And I'm quite one thing I'm very, very keen on is the fact that comics and video games are something potentially that anyone could make without qualifications or having to go to university and things like that. Something I feel really passionate about.
Yeah.
So I want to tell a story that, again, is aimed at a broad audience that I want to show to kids that in time of, you know, austerity and, you know, terrible things that are going on at the moment, that you can still, you know, achieve something and you can still be passionate. And there are ways to achieve things without having to have, you know, go to expensive universities and be in debt for, you know, 20 odd years of your working life. You know, there are other avenues. So it's a story set in that time, but there are some, you know, big fantasy elements as well. It's not a very dry story.
it's something I touched on with Pat when we did the interview last week, is I think we're almost returning to that period. You remember the sort of the spawning ground, which was the 70s and early 80s, of just like huge, across all mediums, just hugely influential and original sort of creations. And I think we're getting there again, you know.
Yeah, definitely. I think we're living in times as well where all those old, ideological or political battles are being, fought again,
I mean, let's face it,
we're back to the 80s, and I kind of forgot about politics for a while, in the 90s. In the 90s, like, everything was just like music and gaming and comics and stuff, and it feels like that old kind of like sort of anger I had when I was a teenager is coming back, and I want to do a comic that's is about that kind of anger, but anger that's directed into doing something creative. 2000 AD came out, people like, they're almost like, the sort of punk.
Jonathan Ross called Pat Mills a punk, didn't he?
He was
a punk. Yeah,
definitely. And I think the problem is, I've seen comics moving into a sort of a middle class niche in a way.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. And it's great. But I am thinking to myself, where are the angry comics? Are the comics about, working class kids and, people who fight for something, I think this is where I'm going to start getting a little bit on my soapbox. I think there are.
Let's do it.
I think there are a lot of the gatekeepers now are quite wealthy and middle class.
Yeah.
And they don't quite understand that kind of working class sort of struggle thing that goes on. And I want to try and cut through that. And I know I'm going to find it a hard time on this new book I'm doing, because it's not. It's not crazy, colourful, fantastical monsters, and wannabe zombies and stuff. It's about a kid during a very bleak time of UK history, but it's a very positive story as well, and I think it's very pertinent to what's going on now.
Okay.
I think it's quite interesting.
You're right. I think autobiographical comics need a restart. I think people now think that autobiographical comics are stories about what band you liked where you went when you went on a walk. The fact that everyone has to state within the first five pages that they're a feminist,
Yeah, and there's a lot of it that is very pleased with itself.
Yes, exactly.
I asked a question. On my Facebook group, because my dad was a tattooed bloke who worked down coal mines from Glasgow. I hung around with a lot of quite un-PC people, great blokes, but totally un-PC.
Yeah.
And I wanted to capture some of that language in the book, and I put a thing out on my Facebook page. And I said, how would you respond to things like this? Like, kids glue sniffing, in the back of bus stops, or these kind of PC comments, or people calling each other spaz, because I get the sense if I put that in a comic and that was on Twitter, people would be in an uproar going, "Oh my God, it's outrageous, this dialogue."
Yeah.
But that's how people in those days spoke.
Yeah.
And this, you don't want to whitewash it.
We can't be safe anymore, can we, Jay? I know Stuart Lee says, write like you want to be fired. I admire that aspect of, we shouldn't be aiming for something just to, it shouldn't be like a cushion you can put your head on. It should be something that challenges you.
I did see someone get berated the other day for writing a comic character, a bad guy, saying something horrible. And I'd sort of jump in saying, what are you talking about? Like, the villain of this piece isn't a reflection of the writer's opinions. This is the antagonist. He's supposed to be horrible.
Yeah, the writer wants a bad guy to not be liked.
Putting them up.
There's a reason he's a bad guy.
But even good guys say stupid stuff. Good guys, good people. The people I hung around with, they were good people, but they spoke a certain way. They did certain things. I remember once I went down when I was like a kid, I did work experience for the coal board, and so I had to go underground in the coal mine for a couple of sessions. And like the songs the miners sang on the trains going, a mile and a half underground were not songs you could repeat. And also they play tricks with each other. Like if you were like the new kid on the block, just joined, gone down the pit, they'd like have their little snap boxes with all the sandwiches and stuff. But they'd play tricks with each other where they were, I'm not joking here, by the way, but they might have a shit down there. And they'd roll up a little bit of the turd in a ball and put it in a bag and offer it out as sweets to the newcomers and stuff to see if they would take the sweet. Things like that. So you would kind of want to catch all those kind of characters.
They caught me about 80 times with that.
there's no HR department down there. These are big working class blokes.
yeah.
Who were caught up in this terrible struggle at the time and demonized by the press. And a lot of people don't really tell those stories.
Nobody could tweet about how outrageous it was, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Some sort of public inquiry into it, you know, sort of. Yeah. That's just how it was. Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with where we are now, by the way. There's nothing, you know, I totally think that, you know, some fights in terms of, you know, political correctness need to be fought, you know, because there's some terrible things going on, especially nowadays coming out of the US. So that's all, you know, it's all.
I agree with you. I think
fine, but I want to capture the voice of that time.
Yeah, there's fights that need to be fought, but there's not fights that need to be tweeted about constantly.
Yeah, and we always talk about the responsibility of a creator. It's all about being responsible. Don't be hateful, but like always be truthful. Do you know what I mean? To an individual character.
Yeah,
definitely. Mm. So that's where I am on my current project.
Very good. Is that with Titan again, is it, Jay?
No, I think it's not. You have to try to look for a publisher that you think fits your material.
Yeah.
And you know, you might not always want to go for the biggest publisher. You might want to go for a smaller publisher. I think one thing to always remember when you're trying to pitch for your, you know, next book or whatever you're working on to anyone listening to this is don't always try to think of the big publishers. Go for a publisher that you think is going to, they might only have a few books on their stand at a comic con, but they might cherish and love, and they'll push those books. Sometimes the danger with going for a bigger publisher that has a, you know, a lot of licensed titles is they're going to push those books more because they're going to, they've had to pay for those licenses. Those licenses are going to bring a lot of revenue, so you want to make sure, you know, when you come to choose a publisher, should they even want to go with you, that is, you know, you've got to make sure it's like it's a marriage, basically. You know, you're going to have a kid together, and this kid is the book. And you want to make sure that couple are going to stay together and, you know, love that child and send it into the world with, you know, all the hopes and dreams that it's, you know, it's worthy of achieving. So you've got to be, you know, very...
Yeah, it's got to be passionate, choose the right publisher.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
So have you ever thought about... I mean, obviously you're going the publisher route. Has the Kickstarter or sort of funding like that ever crossed your mind?
Definitely. I know you guys, I think, have done it, Kickstarter?
We're not brave enough to.
I know you tweet about them sometimes. Yeah, I'm sure you've seen a lot of them.
Yeah.
It's definitely something that is of interest. But you also, I mean, you're also terrified of doing it in case you fail miserably.
Yeah.
And then all the people that everyone can see it. And you died on its arse. And
very public failure.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm a little bit like, you know, like we talked about selling books on social media. I'm also a little bit, you get a little bit unsure of your own ability. So, it's something certainly very interesting. And it's something to consider.
Yeah, you can get a publisher, let them do all that for you. Do you know what I mean?
There are publishers that will do kind of Kickstarter type, you know, systems and things.
Right.
Or you can go down the route of going through a publisher. I guess if you went through a Kickstarter route, you know, some of that money's going to go straight into the book. Royalties isn't the matter. With some publishers, you know, you get different royalty deals, like that, you know, from my experience. Some better than others. You're trying to do the best you can right now for your book or your project or your pitch. But I would say that also you need to think about, if you want to do this again, you've got to think about the next book and where that will take you.
Yeah,
maybe.
Do you get to write a pre-existing character, Jay? Who do you write?
A pre-existing character, character in comics.
Yeah, a character currently in comics, ongoing in comics. Who do you choose?
God, blimey, I've never thought about that before. Oh my God. I don't think I'm good enough, but I really like Nemesis the Warlock. But, you know, obviously I would never do that, and I never would get
that
chance.
You know, I'd have said that for you as well. That's one that was in my mind a few years ago.
That's brilliant,
I would never do it. But it's an amazing universe. That is one of those comics I keep going back to every few years. How did they make that? It's just when I went
and Brian
to see,
Talbot did a great art job on it, didn't he, as well, you know?
Yeah, I really liked his the kind of goth world book, especially. It was really with all the Victoriana stuff, like steampunk before steampunk, really, wasn't it? I went to, I didn't go to the 2000 AD event, obviously, because I didn't get a ticket, I just left it too late, but I went to see Pat Mills and Kevin O'Neill, the day before at Gosh.
Yeah, I must have missed you because I was there at that. Yeah,
yeah, I was there for a bit and then I had to scoot off and get the train home, so chat right. to Pat a bit. And I thought, you know, Kevin was there, but it was very quiet and reserved, wasn't he? You know,
he was, yeah.
All the talking for him. And I wanted to kind of like, you know, you're kind of like, you know, I'm a fanboy, you know, I wanted to go, oh my God, you know, amazing. Like, you know, he's probably heard it a million times. But I was like, wow, it's Kevin O'Neill, my God. And there was a guy in the queue before me who had a page of original Nemesis artwork. It was the iconic page with Nemesis, who was kind of doing that some kind of yoga pose.
Oh, you know, I know.
One says, yeah, I'm yeah. the death dealer, I am the blah, blah. And he had that page. I was like, oh my God.
Oh my God, where does he live?
So he let me hold you, let me touch it. And I had a photograph yeah. with it. And yeah, cool. it was great. Yeah, Nemesis is just awesome. I'm not talented enough to ever work on Nemesis, but you know, if you asked me if I'd ever wanted to create a character, you know, Nemesis would definitely be it.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Cool.
Well, I think awesome. Surface Tension is a massive calling card.
Yeah. Definitely. I can see 2018 knocking on your door. They'd be idiots not to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to all our listeners out there who probably might not have heard of this book before, we highly recommend that you get this.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. It's brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you very much indeed. Really appreciate it.
Jay is paying us. How much is he paying us each?
Well, no, thank Jay. He sent through that the lovely colouring in sketchbook thing. That was absolutely fantastic. When it turned up. Really appreciate that.
Thanks. Yeah, that was basically my convention sort of sketchbook, but called it a colouring book.
You don't get a chance to do many conventions, do you? Because you're too busy working. Is that right?
No, I have to kind of like juggle the sort of time and economics of it all.
Yeah.
You know, it's quite expensive, isn't it? If you've got to pay for your table, pay for travel, pay for your hotel, pay for food, and you have to print out all your stuff, which you may not, you know, sell all of it. And I think if I can go for another month paying my mortgage off, doing a comic book, you know, you go down that route. But obviously, you know, yeah. Also, it's good for your profile going to events. You know, you want to meet people and met some.
Well, I don't think it's going to be. I don't think it'll be long before you're a guest at events, dude. And you know, you get your table paid for you.
That seems like the magical thing. I've never known how you get to that stage, but yeah.
Well, we'll have a word with a couple of people we know.
Thank you very much. I just been by your table. I think it was 2015 to say I listened to the podcast and stuff. I was like, oh,
was
podcast.
That,
that's
that
great.
In Thought Bubble, wasn't it? I think you passed,
yeah, thought,
passed
yes,
by my
yeah.
table.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
I know. I know Gavin as well. The Nazi Santa Claus thing.
Oh, Gavin Mitchell.
Yeah. Gavin Mitchell.
I know he's very good friends of you guys.
Oh, yeah. Cool. Oh, yeah.
He used to work in my local comic shop.
Oh, did he? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Oh, we're learning so much.
Yeah.
Yeah, we both used to talk about trying to get into comics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, nice. If ever you're at a Comic-Con that we're at, Jay, pop by, say hello.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely will, definitely. Another beer.
Oh, lovely. speaking of Comic-Cons, not far away is Leamington Comic-Con,
yes.
The award-winning Leamington Comic-Con.
Mm.
Now, that is Saturday, 25th of March, I believe, is correct?
It is, that's right, mate, yeah.
It's Royal Spa Centre, is that correct?
Think so, yeah.
You normally have all the notes, Tony, so...
I don't know, I've got it written in front of me. I'm just trying to Google it as we speak.
Yeah, no, it's back, they had a year off last year, and it's going to come back in a big way, and not just because we're there.
In spite of us.
In spite of us, it's going to be a great day.
It's a Royal Spa Centre.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, there's going to be plenty of cool comics, small press creators, Q&A panels. There's going to be an awesome pod panel, isn't there?
Is
that
yeah.
right?
We're not sure what form
there is
taking.
Like you're worried about it.
We're getting better.
We are getting
it's
better.
Quite so fucking disastrous as the first time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
We're getting there slowly.
Yeah. I think in about 5 years we'll be mediocre. So there you go.
Yeah. I'm waiting for someone to throw something. Nobody's actually thrown anything at us.
Why
yet,
do you want so someone to throw something at a panel? If you had said that, I would have thrown something at you at the 2000 AD panel, because trust me, I fucking wanted to.
What, when I accused you of being a furry?
Exactly.
That was quality.
I said, just disappear into your seat.
Yeah.
There's only 500 people, so
we're right. Friends like this.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Leamington Comic Con's going to be a great day. There's going to be like, there's a cosplay catwalk. Yeah, there's going to be a kids zone. It's a great family day, isn't it?
It is, yeah, really good. Yeah.
I mean, obviously, our panel might not be family friendly. I try to make it so. But
do you have to advise them of that before you do it?
I don't know.
We probably should.
Yeah. I'm all right. I just hear me. You can't control. That's yeah. what happens.
Oh, whatever. No, it's going to be a great day, though. And also, you know, the small press factor winners, you might hear a bit more about them in the yep. near future.
Yep, line them up.
Yeah. Have we got any other shout-outs or anything this week?
Yeah, I've got a couple, if you don't mind.
Yeah, go for
my old mucker, Ed Traquino, who is an old table mate of mine from... Bristol mostly, and we did a bit of Brighton conventions, and we used to do comics together. He's got a new book out on Comixology called Frenzied. It's £1.99 for 30 short stories, so it's really good. He describes it as funny, vulgar, mean, and outrageous short stories that kids shouldn't read. The highlight of the book for me is a story called Justice about a sort of female superhero beating up a bad guy, only to have everything stopped by a fan who runs in and wants selfies with her, and then asks her what she thinks of her action figure and if it's a little too sexy. And then he goes on to have, and then he goes on to have lots of selfies with the pile of dead bodies on the floor. Very good. If you go to Ed Traquino, EdTraquino.com, EdTraquino.com, or it's called it's called Frenzied, and you can find it on Comixology. Very good. And the other one I've got is Slice Quarterly. As you hear this, hopefully if you listen to it on the first couple of days of release, it'll only have a day or two left. We're really excited. I've written something for it, and I've written the foreword for it, and it's going to be really good. So get behind that if you can on Kickstarter.
Nice.
That's mine.
I've got two Kickstarter shout-outs. Excuse me. First one's El Marvo, which is a bit of a shameless plug.
Yeah,
I'm doing.
It's the almost there, mate. Isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, as the recording of the show is 75%. So
yes, real. Nice.
By the time you listen to this show, it'll be a week. So hopefully, we can get that done before the. I'm sure it hit the total. I'm pretty sure it will.
Yeah, I think.
And
it will.
Yeah, the other one is the Raynard City Chronicles, which it needs a bit of a boost. So if you got a few spare quid, sling that into the pot. There's some great rewards. I'll stick again up on the Facebook page. So good luck with that, everyone involved.
Oh, can I just say, I had a bit of an operation this week. I got rushed into hospital, and just thank you to everyone who sort of sent me the best wishes on Twitter and Facebook and all that blah. Yeah, thanks to everyone for the sort of good vibes. It was much appreciated while I was on a morphium sort of trip in bed. Thanks.
We also was going to give a shout out to long-term listener Sarah.
Yeah, friend of the show. Yeah,
everyone on the podcast, thoughts and feelings of
her. Yeah, she's having a bit of a hard time in it, so just let her know we're thinking of her. There you go.
Genuinely one of the most generous people I've met.
Yeah, really nice lady. Yeah,
and she refuses to talk to us when we've got a microphone.
Yeah.
Actually, a lot of people are like that.
Yeah.
With or without microphone.
Yeah, that's true. Jay's thinking, actually, what have I got myself in for?
Yeah, I'm an hour and a half in now. Yeah.
Yeah, there's no getting out now.
I feel like I'm just about to listen to the podcast.
Yes, so, we've already learnt so much, but I think it's time to recommend something for our lovely listeners, isn't there? So who wants to go first, then?
Go on, you go, Vincenzo. Your turn.
Me?
Go on.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh, blimey. I didn't expect that one. My book this week is the book Realm of the Damned. I almost talked about it last week. Written by Alec Worley, and the art, colours and lettering by Pi Parr. I hope I've said that right. Werewolf Press are the people that put out this book. Now, I've been wanting to read this book for a long time, ever since I saw like the dark and horrific sort of cover image that appeared all over the shop when it was first being promoted everywhere.
Okay.
From comic sites to like heavy metal magazines. At first I thought it might be one of those cases of great cover, disappointing interiors. You know, we've all had those, haven't we?
Yeah.
And then I saw flashes of interior artwork that sort of, it looked to be the same quality of the cover. And I did learn that the cover image of the book is one of the interior sort of pages as well. I saw it came out in hardcover, but... I didn't necessarily want to take a punt on a pricey hardcover if I hadn't had the chance to check out the interiors. Do you know what I mean? I didn't want to buy it online. Yeah. Do you ever have that sometimes, that you really want a book, but because you haven't had a chance to pick it up and flick through it, it stops you? You know, because hardcover...
Yeah, until you impulse, and occasionally you'll impulse buy, won't you?
Yeah. But normally the impulse buy is you know, it might be a creator that you've already had experience with, isn't it? You've got more confidence going into it. Whereas I didn't really know anything about this. I just thought, that looks quite cool. So, therefore, it went on my never-ending wish list. And then flash forward to the 2000 AD 40th event that will stop going on about in probably about 2 years. And like I picked up some great merch from the guys at Plastic Head, who put out like great t-shirts and stuff, and I saw that they were offering this as like part of a deal, the hardcover.
Of course it's this, so I didn't put the two together. All right.
At first I thought that was surprising, you know, because it's, you know, in a room full of Judge Dredd, you know, Rogue Trooper, Nemesis and all that, you had this sort of horror book. And but I later discovered that it was also told in the pages of the Judge Dredd magazine.
Right.
It was chapterized, so it all kind of made sense. It makes sense to me now.
Yeah.
Anyway, I snapped it up, and on that journey home, on the what everyone says is the mega bus, but it was a National Express.
Much posher.
on the journey home, I couldn't help but crack it open to see what it was like, and that was it then. From the moment I opened the cover, like, I knew I wasn't shutting it until I finished the story. First, I was struck by the quality of the presentation. It's a lovely hardcover, and it's got like a nice slip case and high quality printing and paper, etc. Being a print geek, that always goes goes far with me. But then I actually got into the story, and seeing as it's very much a book for mature readers, I think it's only fair to say, holy fucking shit, I love this book. As I said, it won't be for everyone, because it's quite mature in its themes, like content and language.
Unlike us.
Yeah. Like, if you listen to the show, you're no stranger to harsh language, and this book got a lot of it. And it is hardcore horror in a brilliantly comic book universe kind of way. The setup is that the world as we know it is like no more, and like monsters rule the world. So you've got vampire queens, like werewolf lords, mummified rulers, and more sort of vie for power. They're sort of like evil gangs that rule the world. And then, like, amongst this, like, set upon on that backdrop, is Alberic Van Helsing. He's a troubled man, as they always are. And he's being hunted across this world by, like, monsters that he used to hunt himself. And then, like, put upon, on top of that, like, there's an apocalyptic evil, like, gets resurrected and basically cuts a path of brutal destruction that only Alberic can stop, as you do, you know. That's the paint-by-numbers simplification of it. But to see this story play out, it's a thing of violent beauty. Dan, I know you love violence in your books, don't you? In a nice kind of way. I'm not saying you're a nutcase.
Not in your home life. Just, you know.
Yeah.
Just on the streets.
You'll love... I think you'll love some of the action that goes on in this. It's nice, not for the faint of heart. For instance, like, jaws are ripped off, heads are crushed, decapitations and eviscerations are in abundance. It starts off with the resurrection of the vampire lord Balor. I think I've said that right. And that sort of gruesomely sets up the tone of what's to come. Like, within the first five pages, I was like, holy shit, this book goes there, does it? Christ. But from then on, it's like, it's action horror at its finest. And there's actually like appearances from heavy metal bands like Emperor and Behemoth, so it's got a great heavy metal edge. Being a metal fan myself, that was cool, you know. But I also loved that these sort of cameos, they aren't done in a smash you over the head kind of way. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't force it. It sort of blends into the background and story, so you don't have to know anything about that. You know, it just purely adds atmosphere to the piece, and probably like gives a nice sort of idea of what the soundtrack would be like. It's a beautiful looking book. And it would be easy to say that the art is the star of the show, as it is with a lot of books. You know, as soon as you pick them up, the art speaks first, isn't it? But the script was equally as great. Like, well, the script by Wally is sharp, and it sort of rolls along. It's got a great pace, and it has you meeting new monsters and situations in a real fluid way that sort of keeps building the story more and more. It's got, you know, it's got a real rhythm to it. You know, there's lots of everything builds up. So by the time you get to the final rumble, because there is a massive rumble, it really invests you. Imagine if, like, the Batman versus Superman sort of fight at the end actually paid off. So right, you know, this isn't a two panel last fight. It's just really cool and in your face. But back to the artwork. I sincerely hope that I see more work by Pye in the future. It's not afraid of detail and violence, but I was really impressed with like the draftsmanship and like the character design. It's like, really top notch too. The book has some sketches in the back, which is always nice. I love stuff like that. And the designs of all like the heavy monsters, they're all very individual. You know, they've got a real good design sense, which, you know, it carries on through the book. You know, especially in like the case of there's a Queen Nemitari, who's like an immortal mummy, who's like her character's like essentially a trash talking gangland boss, but you know, she's got this wonderful sort of Egyptian death mask for a face, which is bright gold.
Right.
You know, it takes the mummy sort of design in a different kind of way, which is quite cool. Yeah, so it's got
okay.
There's so many great ideas, concepts, and action. Like, then it's all wrapped up in a brutal little package. If you like horror, I know we've got a lot of horror comic fans out there. So if you like your horror, metal, and action blasphemously hardcore enough, because a church does get burned, I will say that.
Oh my god, that's outrageous!
Yeah, some people would be like, "Oh, that's awful," but you know, this book won't be for you if you like that. Mind you, this show probably won't be for you if you like that. But if you do like all that nonsense, this book's definitely for you. It's highly recommended, and it's going to sit very proudly on my bookshelf. I got an absolute steal when I got it. You can find it on Amazon, probably any decent comic shop, and you can follow the creators on Twitter @Alec_Wally and @PiPar. So that's Realm of the Damned. It's also got a Latin sort of subtitle, Tenebris Deus. I don't know what that means because I'm not that intelligent.
No, neither do I.
No. I thought you were about to drop some knowledge on me, Tony. Yeah. But definitely check this out. It's, you know, it's a thing of beauty and I love it. So there you go. That's my one.
Cool. Nice one. So I go
next.
Yeah, you go for it.
This comes from a conversation I had with a creator at the 2000 AD Festival, which you write with Conan about all the time. And it was like, which creator would we like to see on 2000 AD? And this creator, for me, has got that sort of black humour and sort of nasty, satirical cynicism, where I think he'd be great on it, you know. And it's Scout by Tim Truman. Has anyone read this?
No.
It's an old Eclipse book that is sort of a bit of comfort reading for me this week. And he's a sort of... It came out between 85 and 87, 24 issues of the original series Scout and 16 issues of Scout War Shaman. There was a couple of mini series, and it's by Tim Truman. Do you know Tim Truman's work at all? We did Hawk World, yeah. Did some you know, and stuff. Yeah. Eclipse, I really like Eclipse comics, and it's sort of, now that I'm almost finished my run of First comics, I think I might start collecting all their stuff, because they put out some amazing books. They put out like Mystery, Zot, Miracle Man, Air Boy, the original series, well, not the original, but the normal series, not the sex series, Aztec Ace, Detectives Inc., DNA Agents, Mr. Monster, The Spider, many, many more. But they put this out. It was mostly by Tim, who drew and wrote it, but he did have the occasional guest artist. He had Tom Yates, whose work I really love, Steve Bissett, Rick Veitch, who did Swamp Thing, Ben Dunn did a couple of the issues as well. An absolute, just fucking out there mental storytelling. It appeared in the two miniseries as well as the two main series, but it also had a short story in Tim Truman, because he's also like a blues guitarist, and it had a short story in an album called Marauder, which is his band that he played in, called the Dixie Pistols. If anyone's heard of that, I hadn't heard of it. And the reason it came back to my attention, because it is genuinely one of my favourite stories, is it recently got a film deal with Studio 8 Pictures. So I'm hoping it is going to finally follow through and become a film deal. I know they don't all. But basically, America's gone to shit, and it's become sort of warlike sort of gangs. Like Texas is one gang, and the government, the sort of minor government, has been formed, and that's another gang. And the hero is an ex-Army Ranger called Emmanuel Santana, who Truman named after the musician.
I was about to say, did you play a guitar?
He doesn't. Other people do, but he doesn't. But Santana heard about this and ended up being a fan of the series as well, sort of, because it was reasonably well known at the time. And as everything, as you used to get in 2000 AD, it was set in the fictional future of 1999, you know, which has been gone. It's got. It looks like Imagine if the American Civil War was set in the near future and crossed with The Walking Dead and a big handful of mushrooms. Imagine it would be that, but it's got a sort of mystical environmental elements to it. Not quite in the same way as Surface Tension, Jay, but you know, I can see the similarities to it. It's got sort of socio-political sort of themes as well. And Santana is an indigenous person, because we don't call them Native Americans anymore, do we? I think this is indigenous. And much of what happens echoes the history of some of the sort of the tribes of his people. And he's fighting back against the forces. And he basically sort of wanders around the nation, getting himself into trouble for much of it. But being Truman, it got that sort of violent and unsettling and sort of ever so grotesque edge to it. It's political in relation to his extreme caricatures and situations, but it doesn't really rub your nose in it. You know, it doesn't really go mental, political-wise. It's more sort of extreme characters. I can see Trump being a character in it. There's no way that if this was done now, Trump wouldn't own a nightclub somewhere or be, you know, a general in an army or something like that. The mystical element he creates, he sets over the top of the war setting. And Santana, Emmanuel, wanders about, and he has like a spirit guide who's a chipmunk, and behind all these sort of extreme sort of characters, there's these demons, or we think there are these demons that are infiltrating and manipulating America. It jumps very, very chaotically. It's not perfect in any sense, but it's got a real sort of unfocused DIY feel to it. It's a little bit comics with an X from the sort of 60s. There's a little bit of a feeling of that, which is common to a lot of Eclipse's output at the time. But it's got a lot of heart and it's got a lot of character. And what it does is it really does dare to experiment with stuff. And he doesn't care about trends in comics. You know, there's no superheroes in capes or anything like that. And Truman himself is this real sort of individual. He's got a sort of real sort of punk, outlaw, country, blues, Hell's Angel element to him. You know, he'd be perfect for an Angel Gang or a Cursed Earth story, that sort of thing. He was famous in the 80s for turning around a lot of characters, because he rebooted Hawkman into Hawkworld very successfully, which I can recommend, is a really interesting read. Yeah. And takes it into a sort of sci-fi horror element. And he also turned Jonah Hex into more of a horror western series, which was really good. He plays about with characters, something rotten. There's a Hendrix character who plays a guitar as bombs go off. There's a blind preacher who wanders around. He's got this sort of huge group of people who follow him around. And he mistakes the pages of Lord of the Rings with the Bible and keeps misquoting it. they produced a scout handbook at one point, a guide to survive in America, which has got sort of all kinds of satirical written all over it. There's giant mecha in it, there's mutants, monsters, there's an awful lot of rednecks, and there's quite a few Nazis. Old school weapons sort of rub up against sort of new style, and Truman's got this real hard-on for weapons, and anything that was slightly out in a gun that was drawn, he'd be very critical about, and he really knows his gun. Scout himself has got a Israeli 9mm Uzi submachine gun, and he's also got an Automag .44 caliber Magnum. At one point, he also has a .303 Lee Enfield bolt-action machine gun.
There's a lot of gun fans out there going, oh, gun. Oh, yeah! Oh.
That's classic 80s guns.
Yeah. Oh, exactly.
The Uzi. Yeah. Oh, my lord.
The Uzi.
Yes.
Uzi 9mm.
Yeah, oh, exactly. You can see where he was placed. Exactly that stuff, yeah. You know, there's a real feeling that it's like Waco meets the Warriors. You know, there's that sort of thing with demons. You know, there's a little bit of that goes on there. The characters are absolutely brilliant. There's a character called Jerry Grail. Surprisingly enough, Tim Truman also did the Grateful Dead comics. Rosanna Winter, who's an ex-ranger herself. Beau LeDuc, who's this sort of redneck bearded guy. And there's sort of the odd little single-page comic. And it's called LeDuc's Tips for Real Men. And it's real man food. Fried pork rinds, moon pies, beef jerky, tacos, blood red steaks, food to avoid at all costs, bean sprouts, yogurt, granola, chocolate mousse.
That's so he's like my life.
Yeah. So he gives these like little tips to how to be a proper man's man, Beau Duke, who really also is like a beef farmer, you know. The blind messiah is called Doody, incidentally, which I thought was quite cool. It's been released the first 15 issues have been released in a couple of trades by Dynamite recently. I think they've recoloured it, and it still makes really good reading.
But I think they've yet to release the War Shaman issues. If you search hard enough, you'll find it in the dollar bins. I'm sure you still can. He's still a creative force, actually, Tim, and he's done Hawken. He did it with his son a couple of years ago through IDW, which is a sort of Western horror action series. Absolutely brilliant stuff. Really, really good. And he's worked extensively on Conan, at Dark Horse. He did some Star Wars. He did some Sergeant Rock. He did the Kents, if you remember that series, which is what if Clark Kent's parents were cowboys, like settlers. Really good. Yeah, his work on Grimjack is fucking perfection in my eyes. And he also did a graphic novel out of First Comics called Time Beavers, the title of which will never be beaten by any other comic ever.
Time Beavers.
Yeah.
Nice.
He wrote Turak at Valiant for a long time, the original version of Valiant. So go to look at www.ttruman.com. Yeah. Where his original art is also ridiculously cheap at the moment, and I think well worth investing in. I don't like things that obey the rules, really, and I don't like things that play safe, and this certainly doesn't do it. It doesn't all work, and it's a little bit crazy, and at moments it's a little bit heavily inked, but it is absolutely just like a page is jammed full of more ideas than you'll get in 6-issue run at the big companies these days. Nice. Just absolutely brilliant, full throttle.
Looking on Amazon, they've got two volumes, actually. Volume 1 is 196 pages.
Ooh. Oh, there you go.
So
yeah,
so there's two volumes of it available now. So.
Yeah, really good stuff. Yeah, that's my one. It was a bit of sort of comfort food. I was at home for a couple of days this week, and I thought, what do I really fancy reading? And then I got so caught up in it, listening to a load of Grateful Dead music, and I thought, I've got to talk about it now. I can't talk about anything else. So that's the reason I chose that. But it's certainly one of 10 books. Yeah, really, really good stuff. There you go.
Nice.
Jay? Hello.
he was so busy listening to our wonderful recommendations, he fell asleep.
I was genuinely interested in that.
Yeah, so I think
I've got to buy that. Recommendation?
Yeah.
I'll probably recommend, there's an artist I really like, a Japanese creator, writer, artist, Jiro Taniguchi, who sadly died this week, age 69. And he was a very massive popular figure in France. I think he was awarded like some prestigious art award over there. He's not so well known over here. But the book that he created that I would highly recommend if you're interested in the Japanese sort of manga industry over in Japan is a book called A Zoo in Winter. And this is a kind of semi-autobiographical comic by Jiro Taniguchi about his time as a young man trying to break the comic scene in Japan, and he's about him getting his first job at a manga studio, and it kind of what I really liked about it is it shows the kind of mechanics of a manga studio and how they work and how they have different artists who specialize on different areas of the page. So a page, you know, you have one guy doing the layouts and then one guy who specializes in drawing the environments and then another artist who specializes in drawing the characters, another artist specializes in drawing animals or something. So all these artists all work on the same page, which is why they make these huge phone book size books, which is when you're first starting out at comics, you think, oh my God, how do these, you know, one man bands make these huge amount of books? And reality is they're a team effort. And I thought this was a really, really, really interesting book that turns that sort of idea into something like a melodrama, and it's got really beautiful detailed black and white artwork as well. And unfortunately, because he did die this week, a lot of scalpers out there on eBay and Amazon are selling what were probably quite limited edition print runs of his books at crazy prices, but if you can find it at a good enough price, I recommend A Zoo in Winter by Jiro Taniguchi.
Cool.
I mean, just looking at the cover, it looks like beautiful stuff.
Yeah, it's really good. The covers are usually watercolors. The interiors are black and white line work, but they're almost like Jeff Darrow levels of black and white detail.
Nice.
And very nicely paced as well.
Nice. We like a nice pace on this show.
Yeah, it's nice, like Tony's. It's like comfort food, but going in a different direction.
Yeah. Just checking out now. Looks good.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Lovely job. What about you, Dan? Do you have anything?
I've got two, actually.
Here we go.
One, I'll do both quickly. It's going to sound a bit wanky. I came across another podcast.
Here we go.
You slag.
It just popped up. It's brilliant. I've kind of absolutely fallen head over heels in love with it. It's called film reroll, and you can listen to it at filmreroll.com. And what they do is they take popular films and they replay them as though they're playing a role-playing game. So each kind of member of the team or host, whatever, take a different role, and they play out the film. So where a film would kind of be dictated, right, that the good guy's got to win and the bad guy's got to lose because that's what the script says. In this, as they play the game, it might not work out the same way. So I've listened to two. I've listened to Jaws, which is fucking hilarious, and I'm halfway through Raiders of the Lost Ark. And one of the examples is in Raiders, when Indy's at the temple at the beginning and he's doing the sand and to remove the gold idol. In the game, the guy playing Indy gets it absolutely right, so the temple doesn't fall down. it's really worth listening to, because kind of like it provides these little moments. You think, oh, that's great, it's really nice that my idea is playing out. And the second one is actually a comic book which was sent in to us, The Once and Future Queen, issue one.
Oh, so good. Yeah,
Dark Horse Comics, written by Adam P. Nave, DJ Kirkbride, artist Nick Brokenshire, the colorist Nick Brokenshire, cover artist Nick Brokenshire, and it's absolutely fantastic. We think we're going to have an announcement coming up to that soon. Are we allowed to say that, chaps?
We want
to
say that, or
we might as well say it. Nick Brokenshire is going to be on the show.
Yeah, he's a good egg, isn't he?
So excited about. So yeah, check that out before the show hits and sort of.
I think it's out. Point. It's out in a couple of weeks, isn't it? Because we got.
Is it 2 weeks? I thought it was this week. No, is it next week? Is it?
I think it says March 1st.
Oh, is it? Oh, okay. Yeah. So have a look at the stuff online, the previews for it. But we got to see a preview copy of it, didn't we? And it's fun. Nick's really killing good. On it. Absolutely brilliant stuff. Yeah.
And this is from the guys who did the series Amelia Cole, which
that's
is,
right. Yeah.
Yeah, which I believe was a web comic that then became a series.
Is it IDW?
Monkey Brain.
Monkey Brain? Oh, right.
Or was it Action
Chris
Lab?
Chris Robeson. Was it Chris Robeson?
It was either Monkey Brain or it was Action Lab. I'll be kicking myself because as soon as we stop recording, I'm going to think of it. But Amelia Cole, definitely check that out as well because that's brilliant. So
I've got a blurb here. It says it's out with the old myths and in with the new as a 19-year-old chess prodigy pulls Excalibur from the stone and becomes queen. Now magic, romance, fae, Merlin, and more await her. Lend your axe to the creators of Amelia Cole. Start a new age of adventure.
Yeah, it's good, and it just rejigs a lot of the stuff in it. You think, oh, they've gone a clever way with that. Merlin's a spaceman, which I really liked.
Yeah.
And it does say here, Media Call around 5 arcs at Monkey Brain and IDW.
Oh, there you go.
We're
both right.
There you go. We're always right, and and the other people that are right is you, lovely listeners, when you email us.
smooth.
Thanks. I thought it was a little bit ropey myself. Let us know what you thought of this week's show, and if there's anything we need to check out, or if you've got any books you want to send us. We're getting a few in the inboxes piling up again with some quality, but we're always on the lookout for more. So email us awesomecomicspod@gmail.com. Likewise, tony.awesomecomicspod@gmail.com. I just want to announce that our 2000 AD goodie pack winner, who should be listening, is Tom Curry.
Well done, Tom. Congratulations, Tom. Yeah.
Email us with your details and all that, and your credit card details. No. send us your address, and we'll get the goodies out to you.
I'll get it in the post as soon as you do.
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go. Good.
And the books.
That's the second competition he's won with us.
Nice one.
Yeah, he won the one on our talk, didn't he? He won the pork pie competition.
Oh, of course. He just can't stop winning that, boy.
Yeah, well done. You've
got to be in it to win it.
Yeah.
Indeed. And you got to follow us on Twitter to... No, I can't think of anything that rhymes with Twitter apart from shitter. but follow us on Twitter at The Awesome Pod. We'll be telling you who next week's guest is, etc., and there'll be polls, etc. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/awesomecomicspodcast. Or you post up what we're going to be talking about, all the latest episodes, etc. And also get involved and join the group Awesome Comics Talk on Facebook.
It's a little talk. It's all polite and friendly, and people ask advice, and people give it, and it's good.
It's a good bunch of people, and that's the only sort of people that we hang around with.
It is. Well, that's not true. Yeah. We hang around with each other, so I don't suppose that counts.
No.
Doesn't sound like that.
No assurance of quality there.
That's true. Yeah, we set the bar low. Yeah. Thank you for listening to us, whether it is on the website awesomecomics.podbean.com. If you listen to us on iTunes, leave us a nice review, because we love you.
Yeah.
We all love you. Even Jay. Needs any ears.
I love you all.
There you go. So much love that man's got to give.
So
thanks thank for listening, whether it was on the Stitcher Network, the Podnose Network, or just wherever you found us, because we truly appreciate each and every one of you. Now, where can people find us online and our collective books and ramblings, etc.? Tony?
Ezohyez on Twitter, or you can find me at Down the Tubes. And I think I'm making my little announcement of my new project next week now. So there'll be a new one next week as well. Yeah.
Splendid. Dan?
Nice. You can find me on Twitter at Vanguard Comic, and you can read Vanguard at vanguardcomic.com.
Yeah. Oh, it's getting quicker.
I'm getting a lot quicker.
I'm enjoying this. You can find me on Twitter at Jester Diablo, and you can find out more about my comic at theredmousefrommars.com. And Jay, where can people find you and pick up a copy of Surface Tension, etc.?
Surface Tension should be available from hopefully most comic shops, if not try online retailers. You can find me on Twitter at Gun Comics, I think.
Do you go on there, mate?
I kind of go on there too much. Like, yeah, there's just so much to tweet about these days, isn't there? But unfortunately, it's not comics either.
Yeah.
Well, XCOM.
XCOM, yeah, that's what we should
XCOM.
Be tweeting
about. Yeah, I'm actually more intrigued by Yakuza 0 at the moment. Check out some videos on YouTube for Yakuza 0. It looks pretty crazy.
Oh.
Nice one, will do. Oh, yeah, word. Like all that.
I'm looking forward to seeing what you think of it, Tony.
Yeah, is it sexy? this isn't a video game thing, is it? Yeah.
It's very sexy.
It's a sexy video game.
Yeah.
There you go.
It doesn't take much to get me going.
There you go. And what a brilliant way to sign off this week's episode. So from all of us here in Awesome Pod HQ this week, have a brilliant week. Read plenty of small press, indie and beyond. And just as always, stay awesome. See ya.
See ya.
See ya.
Ciao. I tried searching for Red Mask from Mars on Amazon to see if there was like a trade or something out there, and it came up with loads of fetish gear.
Yeah. That is actually his shop.
Yeah.
This is 86.
This is 86. This is brilliant. Right,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Stop laughing, you bastard.
Right. I'd have sex with someone in a Red Mask from Mars mask.
Yeah.
You just like to have sex with someone, wouldn't you?
That's true.
Dan, your dictionary corner.
Hold on, I've got to look this up now.
It's on
I'll
the
send it to you on the WhatsApp.
There you go. And what what did we give him this week, Tony?
Docking.
Docking.
Fucking hell. So Urban Dictionary defines docking. Docking, the act of placing the head of one's penis inside the foreskin of another penis. David and Patrick enjoyed docking immensely because of Patty's stretchy foreskin. Fucking hell.
I thought it was something to do with starships.
Yeah, I don't remember that in 2001.
No.